Hello everyone and welcome to Family Law Live. Tonight we're going to be talking about PAG 2, which is the new updated Pensions Advisory Group report. If you have any questions, please send them to Chloe or put them on the chat. And can I just ask that everyone stays on mute apart from the speakers? So Fiona's on holiday this week and can't join us, but we are joined by Tamsin Kane from Smart Financial, who are financial planning experts. And in 2018, Tamsin set up Smart Divorce, which is dedicated to helping people going through divorce or separation with their financial planning needs. We're also joined by Rhys Taylor, who almost needs no introduction as he has been quite a regular guest on our show. He was one of the founders of the first PAG report and has been an integral part of making this PAG 2 report. Rhys, can I start by asking you to explain the remit of PAG 2 and what's changed since the first PAG report was finalised?
Sure, thank you, Hero, and good evening, everyone. The original PAG report was published in 2019, and gosh, a lot's happened in the world since then, hasn't it? And we've been through COVID and the like, but there's some sort of big things on the skyline which have changed with pensions on divorce. So we've left the EU, for instance. The lifetime allowance has been abolished, and might it come back? The case of McLeod and the ramifications of having to unwind 2015 public sector schemes because of the case of McLeod has been a big issue. And then also Jonathan Galbraith from Maths and Consulting produce some tables, which I'm going to talk about. And so there's some kind of big ticket items that weren't, because they happened after the 2019 report, weren't there. But also we kept a post bag down the years, and I'm gratified to know that mainly it's a friendly post bag of people who've really appreciated what PAG has done for pensions on divorce and the debate about pensions on divorce. But we do have some critics out there, and some of the criticism was unfair. And if only they'd read it a bit more carefully, they would have realised that and wouldn't have written in the terms that they did. But there was some criticism that did land, and we just thought that there were bits and pieces that we could perhaps tighten up, smarten up a little bit, make absolutely clear what we were saying. And so we thought, deal with the post bag and also just a general refresh. There's been some cases that have happened. And by generally updating it, we thought we would sort of enhance the half-life of the PAG's PAG report's influence, which it's had in this area.
Great. Well, if anyone wants to have a brief overview of the changes, you can find it on this link that I've just put in the chat. And in that document, there's also a link to Paul Cobley and Rhys's article about the changes in PAG 2 in the Financial Remedies Journal. Chloe, at the back of the PAG report, there's a page of links to useful cases relating to pensions. Could you just give us a brief run through of the most important ones we need to know about?
Yeah, sure. So I'll just do a very quick signposting, given that there's obviously so much to talk about. But just sort of really highlighting the cases that have fed into the updates with PAG 2 and perhaps brought on the evolution of the discussion in the report. There is, first of all, a group of three judgments that are all 2020. And they're all very useful because they deal with, on a very practical or day-to-day level, I suppose, how to deal with the principles of pension sharing in needs cases. The first of those is W&H, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with. It's been very well known since it was published. It's a decision of His Honour Judge Hess, who happened to be co-chair of the Pension Advisory Group, so knew his way around the first PAG report. And then there are two judgments of His Honour Judge Robinson, which are very useful on a needs basis. The first is called KM and CV, and the second is called RH and SV. And as Hero has said, both of those are in the case list at the very end of the PAG 2 report, where you can find the citations. As I say, in the interest of time, I won't go through all the facts of those three cases, but they're all very useful examples of pension treatment in needs cases. Something they all comment on is apportionment in needs cases. So do you ring fence the pension sharing to apply just to pension accrued during the period of the marriage to include seamless cohabitation? Or should pension sharing apply to the entirety of the pension pot? And all of these needs cases emphasise the principle that apportionment will be rare and difficult to justify in a needs case. That's quite clear guidance, and there is some very helpful discussion of that. All three of those cases refer specifically to the first PAG report, and therefore the discussion about them then feeds through to the second PAG report, which is worth considering if you are looking at a needs-based pension case. And so it's helpful to have that quite clear guidance on the fact that actually these pensions are very likely to form the resource from which these parties' retirement income needs to be met, and therefore on a needs basis that there is a greater weight attached to that usually than contributions arguments. Although it is important to note that in W&H in particular, it's emphasised that there is no one-size-fits-all solution to pension conundrums. So it is important not to treat that guidance as absolute gospel, because it may be that principles apply differently in other cases, as the PAG report explains. And if you are looking at a case in which apportionment might be necessary, there's some helpful discussion of that in KM and CV particularly, and also, as I say, in the report generally. Another element of W&H, as I say, that being really the most helpful case on this, is the argument of equality of income versus equality of capital value. So the case is very helpful for that, and it emphasises that the court is able to take a starting point of dividing the pension so as to achieve equality of income in retirement in the needs-based case, and explains the rationale for that. I'm just going to mute. Someone's popped up there. The other case I wanted to mention is almost the other side of the coin. It's called CMX and EJX, French marriage contract. Again, that's in the case list. It's a 2022 case, and that is a very similar helpful case, but in a sharing scenario. So in that case, the assets were very, very great, albeit the pensions were quite modest compared to the other assets. The conclusion in terms of dividing to achieve equality of income versus capital was the opposite to the needs cases. So there the judge, Mr. Justice Moore, was very confident to say that in equal division cases, division to achieve equality of capital value is to be preferred. And he even went as far as to say as it wasn't necessary in that case to have even obtained a PODE report that illustrated the equality of income calculations, and that was unnecessary. So that is a good example of the principles in a sharing case, and it illustrates and perhaps is a good example of what PAG 2 deals with in terms of when it is necessary to obtain a pensions on divorce report and when it is not.
Thanks, Chloe. Well, that leads me to my next question to Rhys, which is, can you tell us when you actually need a report and when you can get away with not having one and save the costs?
Well, it all depends. I've done more lectures on pensions than I care to mention, and sort of down the years I've tried to think what's the really key thing that if I could just convey, people would be less anxious about pensions and they'd be more comfortable. Because I see this sort of weird subculture in pensions with financial remedies generally, and we paint with a broad brush, both with valuation. You know, valuations can be fragile, they can be chimerical. And then when we divide the assets, we paint with a broad brush as well. Yet when it comes to pensions, I think because everyone's just a little bit frightened of them, we obsess about getting this supposedly accurate figure, and then having a pension share that's accurate down to the last two decimal points, which is just crazy when compared with the way in which we approach the rest of pensions. And so I think the key thing that people need to grasp, and if they can grasp this, then they're on their way, is to make sure that with the pensions before them, they understand the gross value of the defined benefit pension. So there's some pensions which are just really easy to deal with. The defined contribution pensions, you know, if it says 100,000, it means 100,000. The defined benefit pensions can be more complicated because it can say 500,000 when in fact it would cost something like 600,000 to buy those benefits. And so I think the art of not being frightened of pensions, and when you need to ask for a pension report, I think a lot comes down to, do I understand the gross value of what's in front of me? And if I understand the gross value of what's in front of me, why do I need a pension report? And so there will be, particularly with defined benefit pensions, you might well want a pension report. And there's some sort of rules of thumb in the PAG report. The suggestion, but they're only kind of rough tram lines. If the pensions are worth less than £100,000, probably don't need a report. If they're between 100 and 200,000, you might well need a report. It depends. And if it's over 200,000, you probably need a report, but it depends. But that's all about defined benefit pensions. It's just defined contribution pensions. Then you can just sort of add them up and divide by whatever direction Section 25 takes you in. And then there can be other quirky cases where there's something weird going on that means that you need to reach out for an expert. For instance, the problems that are coming about as a result of the McLeod remedy, which we'll talk about in a minute. I mean, it's anyone's guess what's going on with that at the minute. And so there can be very particular reasons why you might need an expert. But I think generally we sort of panic a bit too much about pensions, and they are only an asset in the basket. And, you know, we don't need the absolute precision that we sometimes reach for.
Yeah. Well, I think when we chatted last time, you mentioned a case where you had two NHS pensions, one's worth, say, 500 and one's worth 300. And instead of trying to get an expert and work out everything around that, if you just divide them both by 50%, then you get a pretty equal amount anyway.
Yeah. So they were sort of umming and ahhing about getting a report. And I said, well, look, you know, the cost of the pension share, on each of these pensions, you'll pay less doing that than having the report. So they were a similar age, so it was very easy to do.
Yeah. Tamsin, you often help solicitors and clients draft letters of instruction to PODs. Can you talk about what questions should be asked, and can you give us solicitors any tips on this?
Yeah, absolutely. As Chloe mentioned before, I think the starting point, pensions are intended to provide income. So certainly in needs cases, quality of income is a useful question to ask. And it seems to be that the difficulty is selecting the age at which that equality of income is taken. And many, many times recently, I've seen letters of instruction with quite a list of different ages on the list, and by selecting a lot of different ages, you're extending the number of calculations you end up with, you're extending the length of the report, which is already quite a hefty tome to work your way through. And then you're also extending the arguments that you're going to have afterwards of picking which one of these you choose to agree on at the end. And I think it would be sensible, and a number of pods that I've worked with, you can say, we would like you to address equality of income at X age or Y age, or an age that you think would be more appropriate. And I think that's something that we should use far more often, because the PODs are the people who are writing the report and they're the experts, hence the name. And I think if we can have got a POD that is willing to give their advice on that, that's something that's worth looking at. A number recently where I've seen instructions and we're looking at age 65 and age 67. And as Rhys said, you're going to get decimal points on those different ages. They're 2 years apart. There's not going to be a mammoth difference between the calculations you get from those two ages, but it's probably going to cost your client twice as much because there are twice the calculations required. So I think that's something that's worth looking at. I know there is a concern about always asking for equality of capital. I don't think it's necessary. That might be a discussion, certainly in these cases, that might be a discussion for us to have later on, but pensions are generally intended, as I said before, to provide income, and in these cases, they generally do. So equality of capital is, again, just going to give you more percentages to need to discuss later on. So it'd be my preference that's not requested. And I guess the final one is offsetting, which I know Rhys is going to come to shortly, so I don't want to steal his thunder too much. But I guess in cases where you think there's a possibility that offsetting may be the route that you go down, it is worth asking. This is where my comment flips slightly, is that it is worth asking about offsetting up front rather than needing to come back to it later, because a POD would far rather comment on it up front than is returned to it later on.
Yeah, that's good to know. And what sort of ages, and what do you base the ages on that you're asking for? I don't know if this is a question for you, Tamsin, or more for Rhys. How do you decide the ages that you should be asking for equality of income at?
Toss a coin, Rhys. I think it depends on the age of the client. It depends on the age that they're actually intending to retire at. Depends on the pensions that you're looking at. So, for example, you can ask for, well, an age at which the pension wouldn't be reduced if they were to take the pensions at that age, and I've seen that asked about recently. So, for example, if you weren't going to get a reduction by taking the pensions at age 60, we'll use age 60. That seems a fairly sensible age. But again, as I said, advice from the POD who's looking at the pensions is going to be the best place to start, I would suggest, in that situation.
Yeah, and then there's less scope for arguments between the solicitors.
If I could chip in, I think a lot of PODs will say that the date to work from is the normal retirement date of the dominant pension that's in the case. And so if the normal retirement date is 60, work to that. If the normal retirement date is, I don't know, 63, work to that.
Sure.
Yeah.
And by the time you, as the point's already been made, you know, if you change it to 64, 65 or 67, you're changing it for both of them. So the percentage differences are minuscule and not worth obsessing about.
Mm. One of the changes in the PAG 2 was in relation to offsetting, Rhys. Can you briefly explain that to us?
Yes. At the end of PAG 1, we were all thoroughly exhausted and fed up with it and didn't want to do any more work. But something that we thought, oh, that would be good, but you know, we just don't have the stomach for it, is a set of tables that work a little bit like the Duxbury tables, except they're designed specifically for pensions. And if anyone got that far, you would have seen in Appendix U of the PAG 1 report a detailed explanation of how this might be done. Jonathan Galbraith, who will be known to many of you, stepped forward a couple of years back and said, well, here you go. Here are those tables you were talking about. And he's called them the Galbraith tables. And they are a rough and ready way of assessing the gross value of a defined benefit pension by reference to the party's ages or the party's age and the pension they will have in retirement. And so rather than looking at the cash equivalent, you look at the age they are today, the age when they will receive the pension, and that gives you a factor. And then you multiply that multiplier by the figure which is in the pension benefit statement, and that will give you a rough and ready feel for what that pension is worth. Let me just unpack that a little bit. I've seen Jonathan Galbraith give just a fascinating and learned lecture on how to use his tables. But quite frankly, some of it kind of goes over my head. And I know, because I've used the tables, that what I do is I run my finger across the horizontal from the party's age. And then I look at the column when he'll be able to take his pension. And I run my finger down the horizontal and where the vertical and where the horizontal and the vertical meet, there's your multiplier. And it's kind of as simple as that. There's no real magic to it. The area where we family lawyers have the ability to go wrong is not with identifying the multiplier, but it's picking out what the mathematician would call the multiplicand, the figure on the pension benefit statement. And the problem is this, and this is the key thing to avoid making a mistake on the Galbraith tables. If somebody has got a pension benefit statement, say from they were in employment and they left 4 years ago, and they've got a statement saying, I'm going to get 10 grand a year from age 60. And that document is 4 years old. That £10,000 won't be an accurate figure. The multiplicands needs revaluing to its current value. And so you need to work with up-to-date figures, and you need to make sure that the figure that you're saying will be received on an annual basis through retirement is actually the figure that is the relevant one, not one that is has become stale because of inflation and it being too old. And so I heard one financial advisor say that the Galbraith tables are a bit like a defibrillator, and they will save someone's life, but in the wrong hands, they'll kill someone. And that's all down to making sure you don't select the wrong multiplicand. Multiplier, dead easy on the tables. You find them in the at a glance, and it's super easy running your finger down the vertical and the horizontal and where they meet. That anyone can do that. And then you multiply it by the multiplier. Now, how have these been received? Well, first of all, they're in At a Glance. So that gives you a bit of a view as to what the editors of At a Glance think. PAG cautiously welcome them. PAG says that they are a useful starting point. Now, Jonathan Galbraith has provided an extremely useful user guide, and in the Financial Remedies Journal there's a what I call a quick start guide, and in both of those documents it's apparent that no one is saying that the Galbraith figure will definitely be the absolutely correct figure, but what it will be is a figure that gets you into the range. It gives you a feel for what you're dealing with. I'll give you an illustration. There was a case last year before His Honour Judge Hess, that was dealing with the capitalisation of maintenance. And part of the evidence in that case, they obtained the valuation of a defined benefit pension because the company, the pension company, wouldn't provide one. And it was provided by a PODE. And so behind the scenes, we ran the Galbraith tables next to this expert's figure to see whether or not, you know, they came out the same. And the Galbraith table and the expert figure came out about 10% different. Now then, some people will say, oh, 10%, that's unacceptable. But I would say there's no guaranteeing, bearing in mind that all different experts use different assumptions. There's no absolute saying that the expert in court was right. It was his assumptions in court on the day. Other people might say, well, look, a 10% difference is something that we can live with, and that in a in the valuation of a company or in the sale of a house, we know that the values can go up and down. It all depends. And I just mention that as an illustration of a sort of figure that gives you a sort of a feel for where you are. But Jonathan Galbraith doesn't say it's definitively right down to the last two decimal points. Borrowing from the Duxbury language, it's a tool, not a rule. But I've certainly used it on a number of occasions just to get a quick feel for where I'm at with the pensions. And, you know, if it's a chunky figure, it might, you know, I might be thinking about, well, do I want to go to an expert about this, or the party is going to be comfortable with this rough and ready figure? And so PAG says it's useful as a starting point, but it does list a number of factors that practitioners would need to take into account in terms of, you know, using them cautiously. So they're easy to use. Multiply the multiplier by the multiplicand, but you need to know that they're not, you know, definitively and absolutely accurate, but they are in the range, and they're
used with caution.
Yes. And the last thing I'd say is that they're going to be updated in this year's at a glance as well. Probably the ones that came out a couple of years ago are a lot's happened in the world since then, and it would be probably good for them to have a refresh.
Okay, thanks, Rhys.
Sorry, that was a long answer.
Tamsin, can I ask you about the smart divorce service that you have set up and when it could be a helpful resource for solicitors and their clients?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. Thank you. Before I do that, just want to pick up on something that Rhys said, mentioned just then, that's quite important. You might have a defined benefit pension statement that has a very recent date on it, but still have a benefit amount that goes back to the date that they left that position, that work. A lot of DB schemes don't update that figure, and they just leave it at the figure that of when the person left. So just a note of caution on that as well. It might be an up-to-date statement. Just check it doesn't say benefit at date of leaving, because that would also require progressing on with inflation as well, as Rhys mentioned before. In terms of what Smart Divorce does, we offer a service as financial planners working with divorcing clients, and there are a number of us. I don't want this to become an advert for Smart Divorce, particularly because there are lots of us in England and Wales doing a similar job and are accredited by Resolution for this work. I think some of the areas that I can be helpful to solicitors and their clients, and some of the work that I've been involved in recently, certainly with instructing PODE reports, more than happy to assist on that, and to comment on when there's a response from the other solicitor to say we'd like to change this, to give some guidance as to whether there's good reason for that or whether there might be an argument to stick with the original instruction. And another area is also to try and dissect the POD report. As we mentioned before, they're quite hefty tomes when they come through, and to see how they impact on a client's future life. So we use cash flow modelling. I'm sure lots of you have seen that in action over the years, but it can guide whether a client, and you know, it's again not an absolute science, and we know that nobody's life is going to be work out exactly as the cash flow model suggests, but they are a good guide as to whether the settlement that your client is considering does work for them and should provide them with sufficient income and capital to move forward with their life and to actually accept a settlement, hopefully without the need for court. So dissecting the POD report and working out what percentage actually does work for the client, how they can move forward, and helping to agree an overall settlement is certainly something that we've assisted on. Have also been party to FDR hearings where I've been available on a video call if there's a specific sticking point regarding, particularly regarding pensions, that just needs some input from a third party. Again, we can, you quite often help the client to see, rather than just hearing numbers, because numbers are difficult, especially when you're not used to dealing with the finances. Quite often my clients are the weaker financial party. If you're not used to dealing with the finances, to hear a list of numbers that you might be being offered isn't necessarily particularly helpful. If you can see a picture and say, oh yeah, I can see how that means that I will be okay for the rest of my life, particularly if it's a graph that you've become used to seeing, that can just tip them to being able to be in a position where they can say yes, and we can get that decision over the line, hopefully without needing to go any further.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Rhys, can you tell us about the Fair Shares report?
Yes. So the Fair Shares report is a tremendous piece of work that's been undertaken by Professor Emma Hitchings at Bristol University. And I've had the privilege to watch the work unfold as a member of her advisory panel. I didn't have to do too much, but I've watched what she's been up to over the last few years. And what she's managed to do is to survey 20,000 people who got divorced and didn't go and see a lawyer. And she is able to report what became of them down the line, and what the what their attitudes were, and how they did their deals. And then she drilled down harder on about 2,000 of those people, and so she's just got such a rich data set of information about how people tick on divorce. And if people will forgive me, I would contrast a data set professionally obtained over the course of a long academic study with the Baroness Dietschy's postbag, which she claims gives her enough knowledge to say that there should be reform in the way in which she advocates. I would politely suggest that Emma Hitchens' data set is more persuasive. And it paints a fascinating picture. Everyone's broke. that's one of the features to it, it seems. I suppose people who didn't go and see lawyers. But also how little people regard the law when they come to sort things out. You know, if there's no money but there's a house with a tiny bit of equity in it, well, the mother keeps the house because she's looking after the kids. I'm stereotyping, but you know, that's often the deal that's done, and he'll keep his pension, whatever it is, because that's the only thing that they can do. And so what one sees is just totally pragmatic deals being done with no reference to the law whatsoever, and none of them, absolutely none of them, are 50-50 outcomes. And so it provides a fascinating analysis of, you know, how people are divorcing. And the Law Commission, in its scoping paper, have been required as one of the things they must do is to take this report into account. And so it's quite an influential piece of work. There's a particular chapter on pensions, and it makes for grim satisfaction for the likes of me, because it highlights just how few people who are getting divorced ever have a pension sharing order. It's about 11% of people have a pension sharing order, very low. That's not to say that pensions might not have been taken into account in another way, but certainly very low numbers of formal pension sharing orders. Why is that? Well, it would appear from the Fair Shares report that there are two principal drivers, and they come down to complexity. One is technical complexity, or how do we do this? But secondly, emotional complexity. And there is still a view out there that going after his pension is just not on, and it's beyond the pale, and it's below the belt, and it's just not what you should be doing. And this is 20 years after pension sharing was brought onto the statute book, not more than 20 years, since it's a nod from Nigel there. I say yes, it's a long time ago that it was brought in. But there's still this sort of perception that, well, you know, it's his, he earned it, so he should be able to keep it. And if I'm going to have a civilized divorce, I really shouldn't be doing this. And so there's a PR exercise that, you know, Family Law PLC needs to do in persuading those people that pension assets are just assets which are available for division.
But I suppose they also need to have the money available to be able to draft the consent order and the pension sharing annex, don't they? Because is something that's a bit more complicated to do as a litigant in person.
Well, yes, but you know, yes, there's more work. Undoubtedly, there's more work to be done in simplifying things. But of its you know, nature, it is just a bit complicated. I mean, I think 25(2)(h). I don't know if anyone can bring that to mind, but that's the subsection which says you've got to take into account any benefits that you'll lose the chance of acquiring as a result of the divorce. I've been a barrister 27 years. I'm not totally certain what it means. I think it means pensions, but if there's going to be reform by the Law Commission, I think they should change that, and they should say pensions, so that those people out there who don't think that they're entitled to make a claim, they can see on the statute that no, they can. So yeah. I commend the Fair Shares report. There's both there's a long study. It's about 300 or 400 pages, but there's an executive study that's about 6 or 7 pages. A really good read.
Thanks, Rhys. Can you briefly tell us about the case of McLeod that we touched on earlier and the impact that has had?
Okay. So Chris Grayling, remember him? He was told, don't bring in these pension reforms. They're age discriminatory and it will create a nightmare. He wouldn't listen. And the judges and the firemen went to law about it, and they won. And the 2015 public sector schemes were found to have been introduced in an age discriminatory way. And McLeod, if anyone's interested, is Master McLeod, the well-known Chancery Master, who was the lead name in the case. And so that case went to the Court of Appeal. The government eventually just accepted that they lost. And so they have to do something to correct the age discrimination which they brought about as a result of the 2015 schemes. And what they're doing is they are rolling back the 2015 schemes into the earlier legacy schemes. But the complication is that for many people, rolling back may give them advantage, but for some people, it actually suits them to stay in the 2015 scheme. So you've got this absolute horlicks of a situation where no one actually knows necessarily what the best choice is. And so the what is known as the McLeod remedy has something called a deferred choice underpin. And that is that the pension holder can choose at the point of their retirement which of the two options they want to run with. And from the 1st of October 2023, all public sector schemes should have been publishing their cash equivalents for 2015 public sector schemes, both as a pure 2015 scheme and also as a rolled back 2015 scheme. But my understanding is that, you know, different public sector pensions are rolling this out at different paces. It's not all working exactly as it should. And certainly with the state of things as they currently are, if you've got a substantial 2015 public sector scheme, I would probably be reaching out to an expert, say, you know, even if I hadn't formally instructed a POD, you know, going to a, you know, going to someone who really understands this, who can sort of advise you as to how you should be approaching it, because a lot is up in the air at the minute as a result of the kind of the shifting sands of the way in which 2015 public sector schemes are being dealt with. So
is it a worry to settle things at the moment if there's so much uncertainty, settle cases with these sorts of pensions in?
I'd want to think about it. I mean, at the very least, I would want if you're going to proceed, I would want it to be clearly minuted that if someone's decided to proceed, that they've been warned that there is this complexity.
Yeah.
And many of you will be aware of the case of Lewis and Cunnington and of the perils of an ill thought out disclaimer.
So that leads me on nicely to that case. Chloe, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, of course. So this was a negligence case, a successful negligence claim. The case was before Her Honour Judge Coe, King's Counsel. It related to advice not given about pension sharing. So in a nutshell, there had not been full disclosure between two parties, but it was known that the main asset in a long marriage was the husband's police pension, which was very valuable, particularly in the context of the assets available. The wife asked her family law solicitor, who were then the defendants in the negligence claim, to draft a consent order reflecting the agreement she had reached with the husband, which did not include any pension sharing. Whilst the wife did ask for advice, she was involved with her solicitor on a limited basis. She had signed a disclaimer to that effect. It's noted in the judgment, which is relevant, that she was vulnerable and unsophisticated in these matters. What the defendant's solicitors said to her was that they could not advise her at all without full disclosure, despite knowing, as I say, that really the fact was there was a very large police pension in this case as the primary asset. What the court found in the negligence claim is that the solicitors were negligent and wrong to say that in the absence of full disclosure, there could be no advice given. It was said that the solicitors had a duty to advise her that the court would have almost as a certainty have made a pension sharing order And that would likely have been on an equal division basis. So she should have been advised, even though there was not full disclosure, to have pursued a pension claim. There was also, that it's mentioned, I know this comes from Martin Dye, but the firm had also not served a Form P, pension inquiry form. And it was emphasised again that in any case where a pension sharing order might be made, that must be done at an early stage. So it was quite a clean set of circumstances in that it was fairly obvious, as I say, in really it's often a rare case in which you can say with almost certainty what might happen in financial remedy proceedings. But of course here it was an almost certainty that she would have had a pension share of about half of that pension. And so it does emphasise that there is a duty to grapple with those high level issues, even if there is not technically full disclosure. So that is something that's mentioned in PAG 2. And it also gives a bit more advice about the situation on that topic, where you might have advised that a POD report is necessary and a client doesn't wish to follow that advice. And what PAG 2 says is it would be very important to keep a record, include the reasons they have given and have the client sign that, because of the duty. And as I say, that really is highlighted by Lewis as to the extent to which that needs to be grappled with.
Thanks, Chloe. I just wanted to mention another thing that PAG 2 brings up about foreign pensions. So we always need to be careful when we're making orders against foreign pensions, because obviously an English order won't bind a foreign pension company. And if we have one coming in from abroad, there's got to be some jurisdiction for a Part 3 claim here to be able to make a pension sharing order here. I had a case come to me, it would have been an order in America, but both the parties had remarried. They hadn't done anything about it. Both had then got remarried. So there was just no way to then make that pension sharing order. So it's just, yeah, always important to think about those other considerations with foreign pensions. Chloe, can we go to you now to go through any questions you have?
Yes, so we have one excellent question, which is, to what extent do we think paragraph 6.3 of PAG 2 is likely to be adopted by the courts? I'm sure Rhys knows without needing to look what paragraph 6.3 says, but I've just reminded myself that it's, in summary, it's the idea that the court might give a primary carer a greater share of pension on the basis that they are less able to rebuild pension and capital in the years until retirement. It's a really interesting question, and I'd be interested to know what Rhys says about this. It occurs to me, I think it is very much in keeping with the needs cases and the emphasis on those principles that we've seen in the recent case law. But it almost strikes as a little bit of a compensation type argument to my mind. It's in terms of how that fits into the principles of what the court is aiming to do. It's not looking at sort of need on a strict basis. It is talking about the disadvantage that a party is going to have for the rest of their working life versus the other. So it's very interesting. What do you think, Rhys?
Yeah, well, can I just mention as well, it's paragraph 630 rather than just...
Oh, 630. I'm so sorry, 630.
And that's okay. but it comes back to the point that I was making earlier, that pensions are just assets. And the assets which we deal with in financial remedy cases, we chop up in all kinds of different percentages. Yet there's this incredibly strong tug towards equality, whether it be equality of income or equality of capital, in the pension context. And I think it largely comes about because the lawyers aren't mathematically able enough to kind of rework the figures to do anything other than have the equality which they asked for from the Pode. But I don't see anywhere in Section 25 a requirement that everything has to be equal. We all know that there's a glorious host of reasons why things don't end up equal. And so why not in the pension context? And so it would be very interesting to see.
Has anyone ever seen it?
I've not seen it. But you know, it will be very interesting to see that now being in PAG, and well done, Michael, for flagging it to everyone. Mm. It'll be very interesting to see whether, you know, people trot along, you know, in front of their judge and get that paragraph out and say, well, what about this? And, you know, and maybe people will think about it slightly differently. And so, I don't think there's anything theoretically wrong with what's being proposed there in the right case.
I suppose if you did an illustration of a projection of what the financially stronger party is likely to end up with, having contributed on the basis of their income projection versus the weaker, you would probably see, as you say, on a needs basis, well, actually, that the reality is they're going to be in wildly different positions at retirement age. Yeah. So why wouldn't you split at this stage unequally if what you're trying to achieve is, is something on a needs basis? It makes sense, doesn't it? But then I suppose that maybe that's crystal ball gazing.
And also, you know, does it have to be that scientific? Can't a judge just say, well, I've got this report here, but I'm very concerned about, you know, inequalities here. I'm going to bung another 5% on applying my Section 25 discretion. No one seems to have
No one seems to be asking for it, but maybe that is a people should be.
Well, you know, I mean, we get reports for a reason, don't we? But but you know, in the process of trying to understand the value of pensions, we've almost allowed the figure in the Pode report to become the outcome as well, and it doesn't have to be. It's just expert evidence to guide the court on what the likely outcome might be, subject to the court's final decision.
Yeah. Are there any more questions, Chloe?
No, that's it. That was a very good question for us to finish off with.
Thank you, yeah. Michael.
Yes, thanks everybody. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you all next month.
Good evening.
Bye. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
I think everyone's gone. I'll call on the WhatsApp.